I'm going to ask if somebody else would read Daniel chapter 6. I would probably start coughing through it if I tried to read it. Okay. All right. Yeah.
It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the kingdom, and over them three high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps because of an excellent spirit. The king planned to set
Okay, thank you very much. So you met Darius the last couple of weeks when you were in Daniel 5. You met him at the end of Daniel. And this chapter now corresponds with chapter 3. These last two chapters that we went through, chapter 4 and chapter 5, what was the main takeaway from those chapters? Remember, I'm thinking back now at the outline I gave you at the beginning. Remember how it formed a chiasm? And we spent a week going over what we can learn just by the way from what Daniel, how he structured the book. And Daniel 6 corresponds with Daniel 3. Remember what happened in Daniel 3? Right, exactly. Daniel 4 and 5 corresponded to each other. What happened in those two chapters? What happened in chapter 4? I know it's just a shy group because I know you know what happened in chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar went to what? Yeah. Well, yeah, he might have gotten converted there during that, but what was his low point there in chapter 4? He became a cow. Precisely. So God humbled him, right? And like Nick said, it sounds like he very likely could have got converted as a result of that. What happened in chapter 5? Yes, it was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. Belshazzar, his father, I believe, is Nabopolassar or Nabonidus. Nabonidus. Nabopolassar was before Nebuchadnezzar. The temple. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so in both cases, in 4 and 5, it was the humbling judgment of God on a Gentile ruler, right? Right. The night that Belshazzar died, the Persians invaded Babylon, the city of Babylon, took it over with almost no resistance whatsoever, and Belshazzar was killed. So if you look at the last two chapters, God is able to humble Gentile world rulers. Chapter 3, the fiery furnace, and now this chapter, chapter 6, he's able to rescue those who trust him, His people trusting him. He's able to rescue them. So, again, we're seeing part of that emphasis. God is in control, and he is controlling the flow of history, and he is able, no matter what the odds look like, he is able to protect his people who trust him, and he is able to humble even world rulers, emperors. So I just wanted to remind you that there is a superstructure to Daniel. There is a table of contents. There is an arrangement. And Daniel's been going through these things methodically. This is over 67 years, close to 70 years of ministry of Daniel, of life in Babylon. And he's only picked out six incidences those almost seven decades to share in this narrative part in Daniel, in the book of Daniel. Yes, Nick. If he didn't, he got to know it real fast, right? I think one of the reasons chapter 5, Belshazzar met his end the way he did, is God, while he was judging Belshazzar, at the same time he was setting Daniel up with Darius. Because remember when Daniel interpreted the handwriting on the wall, what did Belshazzar do? Pardon? He was scared, but what did he do for Daniel? Yeah, the third ruler in the kingdom. And then that night, the Persians entered Babylon and took it with almost no resistance whatsoever, and Belshazzar was slain. I don't know if Daniel was standing there with purple on. Yeah. Just gifts. I wasn't seeking them. But then we saw in the opening verses of Daniel 6 that Darius set up Daniel as one of the three presidents to oversee the 120 satraps. So I don't know if Daniel being given those rewards right at the end of Daniel 5, if that influenced Darius in selecting Daniel as one of the presidents, one of the three presidents. But then afterwards we see that Daniel proved himself rather rapidly. So, yeah. How much Darius knew of the events under regarding Daniel and his three friends under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar, don't know. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So now think about this. So think about this. There's seven decades of history has gone on with Israel in Babylon, and we've seen how God gave Daniel and his three friends favor from the get-go, and how he raised them almost immediately to the, certainly within the first 4 years of their captivity, raise them to the highest echelons of the government. And we see how Daniel's emphasizing that God is present with them. He is control. He is giving them favor. He is showing them that God is able to protect his people from those foreign world powers, and how he is able to humble thoroughly the leaders, the emperors of those world powers. And so chapter 6 will end the narrative part. Chapter 7 through 12, we're going to get in to the apocalyptic part, all of the visions and all that. So let me ask you this question. Is there a connection, do you think, in Daniel's plans as he was laying out this book? Obviously being directed by God, but in his plans laying out this book, do you think there is a connection between these incidences that he shared in these first six chapters and preparing them for him writing about all these visions in chapters 7 through 12? Do you think it was just coincidental that he just shared these six or so incidences before he starts writing down the visions that he'd been given? Yeah. Wes is convinced it's just pure coincidence.
It's too simple of a yes or
no. I know, it is. I know. So the follow-up question is the more important one, isn't it? And that is, how does those first six chapters prepare the nation, the empire really, as well as the Jewish nation, prepare them for these visions? Right. Exactly. So that they needed to see those what happened in those first six chapters. They needed that for confidence about what God's telling them in these next six chapters, chapters 7 through 12. I mean, seriously, you think about that. God's deliverance of the three young Hebrew boys in the furnace was so extensive, so detailed, they didn't even have the smell of smoke on them. Nebuchadnezzar became a cow, you know? Handwriting on the walls become a universal euphemism and all of that. Those incidences very much emblazoned in Israel's mind, and any Gentile in the empire that was paying attention, that God is in serious control, and what he says he will do. And so obviously that was part of Daniel's design of the book, was to select those six historical incidences and the highlights of seven decades and to prepare them to receive the visions they're going to get. Because as we get into these visions, there's, you know, obviously the ultimate story is Jesus wins. You know, the Ancient of Days calls the court session, court into session in heaven in chapter 7. And the Son of Man is given his people and assumes judgment and all of that. But when we get into these visions, we're going to see there's going to be some real dark days for the people of God, not just for Israel, but for the church too. That's Revelation. That's where Revelation comes in, and shows us that the Antichrist wearing out the saints includes church saints. That's what that's all about. And so there's some dark days ahead, and so we need to know for sure that God can control things, and in ways that just blow our mind, like we see in chapter 3, where they don't even smell like smoke, and like where we see in chapter 6, the one and only time that lions fasted right along with the king. It's funny, you know. In the Apocrypha, you know what the Apocrypha is? There's one of the books, Daniel, Bell, and the Snake. In that story, they have Habakkuk, a prophet of Israel, being transported in the spirit into the lion's den with Daniel and serving Daniel stew and bread during the night. Obviously, Daniel, Bell, and the Snake is not part of the canon of Scripture, but I found it funny because when you look in chapter 6, the king fasted and then the angels made the lions fast, but according to the Apocrypha, Daniel was down there with Habakkuk eating stew and bread. Anyways, I found it funny. So anyway, let's get into this story. The author divides the chapter up into five sections. In his first section here on top page 52, Daniel promoted, chapter 6, the first three verses. And the author writes, clearly Daniel is a responsible and faithful senior servant of the empire. In the opening verses of this chapter, what indications do we have of Daniel's trusted status? What'd you guys write down there? Evidences that Daniel was a very trusted senior servant of the empire. Yes. Yes. Did you hear Nerupa? He was one of the three administrators or presidents over the overseeing all 120 satraps, and the king really liked his spirit. And a satrap was a province, and a satrap was one who was over a satrapy. Yes. Yeah. Oh, Seth asked what a satrap is. And that's like a governor over a province. Babylon was divided into 127 provinces. Apparently, Persia had 120 regions, satrapies. Nerupu also said the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So those are three evidences that Nerupu brought up of how Daniel is a trusted. It's clear that Daniel is a trusted servant of the empire. Right. So they had 120 provinces and a governor over each one of them. And then the king had three presidents that oversaw those 120 provinces.
One of the things I liked was that that little comment at the end of verse 2, says so that the king might not suffer any loss.
Yes. Darius, you're talking about, yes.
So he says, so that I can avoid that, I want this guy.
Yes. Yes, the whole organization of the government, one of the key goals in the whole organization of the government, of the imperial government, was so that the king would not suffer loss. Did anybody else have anything else there? I had one other thing, but it's pretty much along the same lines as Nerupa's second item. That is, he distinguished himself above all the other presidents. Yeah. Yes. Yes. With the crown jewels. Yes. Yeah, very good point. Did you hear that? Wes said that Daniel exemplifies the kind of reputation that elders are supposed to have to outsiders. They can be trusted. Very good. So now, the second section, which I'll let you, well, second section begins with a miracle, but I'll let you guess what the miracle is. Number two there, the administrator's plot to remove Daniel. How do Daniel's faithfulness and reliability pose a challenge to the administrators in their plot against him? What do they think is their only chance of catching Daniel doing something wrong? So two questions there. The first one is, how does Daniel's faithfulness and reliability pose a challenge to the administrators in their plot against him?
Because they were set. themselves had this intense loyalty to the empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so already it wasn't just about, I just think there should have been some kind of teamwork there.
Except remember verse 3. Daniel distinguished himself above all the others.
So then it just comes down to jealousy. But I mean, to get rid of him means that just so that they could be number one. That would have been them.
You tell me.
I just don't think it could have been like we want to take.
No, it's clearly, obviously, a jealousy thing here. Yeah.
Well, to answer the first question, then, it's just it posed a problem because they knew that the guy was squeaky clean.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to go behind the king's back. He wasn't going to not follow the mandates and the dictates of the law. He's going to function under that system, for the honor of the king, for the glory of God.
Right.
It was ironclad.
Yeah. Yeah, and so therein lies the miracle. Squeaky clean 70-year politician.
That's the miracle.
That's the miracle. Look around. I didn't come up with that joke, though. Dr. Davis did. Yes, so they could find no error, fault, or corruption in his work as grounds for any kind of complaint whatsoever. We're talking 70 years. That's a lot. And in the highest levels of government and offered all kinds of gifts and stuff, as we've seen in chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5. And yet, incorruptible. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Then the next question. What do they think is their only chance of catching Daniel doing something wrong? Right, so making up a law that what? Right. Right. So clearly, Daniel has a strong allegiance to the ruler, to his human boss. Okay, and so much so he's squeaky clean. And so what they're doing here is they decided that the only thing that they can do to catch him is to pit his faithfulness to God against his allegiance to Darius. To pit one against the other. So that's why they chose that's why they contrived the certain law that they contrived, right? Now, what does, the author doesn't ask this, but what does, notice in verse, let's see. Oh, the law. Notice. Let's see. Notice the law that they propose. Pardon? Yes. Then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king. Wait a minute. No, not that one.
Verse
6 and 7. Yeah, verses 6 and 7. all the presidents of the kingdom. Now, is that true?
Minus one.
Minus one, yeah. Well, two-thirds of the presidents. All of the presidents and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, O King Darius, live forever. They're going to have a Darius appreciation moment first before they propose this law. All the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, what exactly are they wanting prohibited? Because notice, they said, whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. So does that mean when you're sitting at the supper table, the dinner table, do you have to go ask Darius to pass the beans? Isn't this what that says? Any petition to any god or man. Not just God, but also man. So, just what exactly are they talking about here? How would how would Darius understand this? I mean, we probably just kind of skipped over the word man there, right? And the fact that the law was prohibiting that.
Isn't it safe to assume that there was already a level of governmental petitioning already in place? That sometimes it would go to the satrap level, sometimes it would go to the local level, and they're saying, no, let's just do this and bring it to the king just to show that there's ultimately end to the king for this chunk of time. Would I have to do that?
Well, I have no doubt that there was that system in place, but I think it has more to do with a man being a go-between between God and men. So more like a priestly function, I think, is what is being indicated here. So I don't think it would include a request to pass the beans at the dinner table, okay? But I just wanted to point that out to you, that how extensive it is, and get you to think through that. What is he talking about here? Also, why would Darius go along with something like this? What do you think he might be thinking? I'm the man, yeah. Some think that. Some think that. Several think that he's all flattered being treated like a god. Here's what I think is actually going on. I think, remember, this is just, they just defeated Babylon. They're just setting this up. He's just getting his government in place. And what is one of the big concerns whenever one empire conquers another empire? What's always a big concern? Rebellion, exactly. Trying to get everybody under control. And all of that, and I think what he probably saw in this was an opportunity to emphasize that he is the new sovereign, and that he isn't, I think he saw it as a unifying, controlling thing. Here's the thing. In the ancient Near East, many times rulers were viewed as they were treated as sons of the deity, sons of their god. So I don't know that I don't know that Darius actually was thinking that, they're treating me like God. I'm a god here. I think he probably interpreted it more politically. Lots of rulers are treated, seen as sons of the deity, as representatives of the deity. And so they're saying, you're the only representative people goes to make requests of their god. They don't go to the god directly. They don't go to any other representative, no priest, nothing. They go to you. And so seeing it as an emphasis that he's the new ruler, he's the son of the deity, he's the one that's in control, we're going to get everybody on the same page here, and it's only temporary, right? So it's not like it's the emperor worship that we saw in the Roman Empire later. Yes.
A couple of questions. And so enough time. I mean, I'm just following the end of chapter 5 into chapter 6 as far as how that plays out. There was enough time that passed from Darius coming in, taking over, recognizing Daniel and his character, mm-hmm. enough, so much so to promote him to a president's position, and then for the others to watch him in his consistency. To recognize that the only way that, I mean, we don't like this guy, he makes us look bad or whatever the case, we got to get rid of Daniel. So all of that is established, and then it's still close enough to the beginning of the setup of the new government to
yes.
come in. And so,
yeah,
so
it like takes a while.
A month, 6 months, a year?
I have no idea. I don't know if you can read some timing into the flow of the text here, but clearly Daniel had a standing before Darius took over, and many of those people in Babylon were there during Babylon's empire.
So again, just like Nebuchadnezzar would have summoned, was it Hezekiah and those to go to the this tall statue or throne of the fiery furnace,
right?
Fiery furnace there, Daniel, or lion's den here. Test of allegiance.
I don't know if you can carry the comparison to all those details, but I do think that what's going on here is you're in the early stage of Darius setting up his kingdom and his government, and Daniel's making a rapid move because of his character and the wisdom that God gave him. And I think that the other governors, the other 122 guys, the 120 satraps and the other two presidents, they're taking advantage of this situation of Darius's relative unfamiliarity with all of them. And they are making a political move to get rid of Daniel. Darius completely misunderstands, misinterprets the other 122 guys' reasoning in their motives in all of this. He's just, I don't think that he's being a sap. I don't think he's being a weakling. I think he's just totally misunderstanding those other rulers' motivations. And he's seeing this as a political opportunity to galvanize his government, the upper echelons of his government together, and as well as the whole country, them celebrating, so to speak, his ascendancy to the throne, representative of the deity, and all of that. So I don't think he's a weakling and a sap here. I think Darius simply totally misinterprets these guys' motivations. And, pardon? Yes. Yeah. As we find out at the end, by the end of chapter 6, those other 122 guys completely underestimate Darius. Yeah. So I think that's what's going on there. I mean, you read lots of things, people saying, oh, Darius is an example of a weak leader here. Well, no, I think probably he's an example of an optimistic leader that totally underestimated the motivations of those leaders around him. But then they, in turn, totally underestimated Darius.
I had never looked at this in the way that this is coming across now. I was always of the opinion that Darius brought in his own people to handle these new territories. And it sounds more like he's going to just pick guys that are familiar, that he didn't know, familiar with the locations, absorb them into his government.
Right.
And
yeah. Clearly, he's got trusted advisors and stuff around him and all of that. But when you're talking about setting up the government of an empire that's as extensive as Persia was, then and Babylon before it, you're using people from other nations to involve. Plus, there's a sense of them being ruled by not just Persians, but by some of their own kind, being governed or managed by them anyway.
So there's another nuance there that informs that. These guys who are the newly captured, who are going to be promoted theoretically to these satrap governor positions, they're coming to Darius with, you know, citing his own law and saying, hey, you know, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, let's do this.
Right.
So that's another reason why he said, oh, okay, now I understand where these guys are coming from. This is a good move. They understand what needs to happen.
Yeah. But that also should have probably maybe been a clue to Darius that maybe these guys' motivations aren't all that good. But he's a busy person setting up shop and all of that. So anyway, So the next question here is that the author goes on and says, reread the gospel accounts of the trial of Jesus. How does the administrator's plot to remove Daniel resemble the Jews' strategy to see Jesus condemned to die? What motives underlie each? Did anybody do that? Go back and read the accounts of the trials? Good. Good. And so I just broke out my trusty harmony of the gospel, and so I had them all side by side. But anyway, so what did you find? How did you answer that question? Yeah, yeah. Pilate even made that explicit, didn't he? Yeah, he saw that the Jewish leaders were doing this because of envy, and so he redoubled his efforts to try to clear Jesus. Yeah. Yes, yeah. And it was interesting to me when you looked at the trial of Jesus, there was the initial internal phases of the trial where it was before Annas and Caiaphas, long before you went to Pilate. And in that phase, you saw something similar to what you see in verse 4 here, where they couldn't find anything on Daniel. Well, the Jewish leaders are bringing on in all kinds of false witnesses to say things, and even in their false testimonies, they couldn't even be consistent with each other. It was obvious they could not establish anything consistently. So what did they finally get Jesus on? Well, that's the pitch to Pilate. But I'm talking about in their own internal, the first phases. So what did they actually had to enlist Jesus' help, right? Come on, man, just tell us. Are you the Son of God? Yes, I am. Okay, we don't need even more witnesses. And it just kind of cracked me up when I was looking through that. They were going to all of this effort to try to build this case against him. And they couldn't even get the false witnesses to get their stories straight and all of that. So in the end, they ended up having Jesus tell on himself. Yes, I'm the Son of God. And then that's now when they went to Pilate, they had to take a different tact. And that's exactly what they did, Pam. They played Pilate's sense of justice and understanding that the Jewish leaders are trying to pull a fast one here. They played that sense against his fear of Caesar. And the card they played is he claims to be a king. And that's treasonous to Caesar. Are you going to let this treasonous guy off the hook? And so that's the card they played on Pilate. But anyway, yes, similar tactics, similar frustrations, and identical motives, jealousy, envy, and all that. Good. Okay, well, maybe we'll just stop right there, and we'll... Because this next one, he's got two parts, and I've added a third part. So maybe we'll, instead of just barely scratching the surface in the last 3-4 minutes, maybe we'll just stop right here. But first of all, any questions over these first few questions or this first section of the chapter? Almighty. So, Seth, would you pray for us, please?